All right, everyone, let's get the show started. Welcome to our DevOps office hours. It's September 23rd. My name is Eric Osterman, and I will be leading the conversation. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator, and that means that we help companies own their infrastructure in record time by building it together with your team and then showing them the ropes. If that sounds interesting, head over to cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. Again, that's cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. For those of you new to the call, the format is very informal. My goal is to get your questions answered. So feel free to unmute yourself at any time if you want to jump in and participate. If you're tuning in from our podcast or YouTube channel, you can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/office hours. We will automatically post a video recording of this session to the Office Hours channel, as well as follow up with an email so you can share it with your team. So with that said, let's kick it off. I don't have too many announcements today, unless anybody else has some to add to this. One of the things that was announced was GitHub is going to shut down API access using just password authentication, which pretty much no one should be doing anyways. And using personal access tokens is still totally kosher, so it shouldn't affect pretty much anyone. But if you were hard coding like your GitHub bot user's password somewhere, that's going to stop working pretty shortly. They have a date here. I'm just struggling here in my thing to do it. So,
The passwords or basic authentication? I thought it was basic authentication that they were giving out.
basic auth has already been deprecated, I believe. I was using basic auth in a bunch of places with personal access tokens, and I think that stopped working. And this is yet an additional deprecation, which is the use of the actual account level password. As of November 13th, 2020, that's going away. All right, then the other, any questions related to that one on API access and passwords for GitHub? The other announcement is that Amazon has added an additional region for EKS, so it's now available in North California. Previously, it was only Oregon on the West Coast here. So, okay then. Talking points. Man, we got a lot of questions to get through today. We'll also try and get to any that are posted in the Slack channel. Let me queue up the Slack channel. If you haven't yet joined our Slack team, you can head over to slack.cloudposse.com. Again, that's slack.cloudposse.com, and you can participate in the conversation there. We have an office hours channel where questions can be posted. All right, that's a good one. I'll pin that one from you, Brian. And we don't have to get through all these questions in order, but let's see how far we get. So, one question that came up just relatively recently that I think is relevant to others doing some continuous integration, especially like on Kubernetes, is what to do with your preview environments when your developers go home. Should you be shutting them down or leave them online, or are there other trade-offs that you can make? So, preview environments, also called review apps, is a concept I believe originally kind of invented by Heroku, which is this idea where when you open up a pull request, that can bring up a complete environment of your application with its backing services, and you can use that to do some acceptance testing on that pull request. If you ever run a very busy organization, that can get quite busy with lots of preview environments. Easily, I've seen over 50 to 100 of these laying around, and that might end up costing you some extra money. So, There are two ways. Well, so the first question is it worth to shut them down? I would say, business-wise, it's worth shutting them down, but it's not necessarily a cut and dry solution because as your team grows, your team will be working at different hours throughout the day. You might be a distributed team geographically. So, what is the start of a day or the end of the day is not obvious. Other considerations are some people putting in extra hours on nights and weekends. And then, if their environments are getting shut down randomly because of these automated processes, you aren't necessarily doing anyone any favors. So, I think a better approach to this would be one where it's based on activity of perhaps a pull request. So if the pull request hasn't been synchronized for a number of days, then that environment might get automatically suspended or destroyed. Is anybody leveraging preview environments? And if you are, how are you handling the case with just orphaned environments and the cruft that builds up?
We piggyback on our QA cluster. So we just deploy PR instances into, or PR deployments into prefix namespace with just the PR as a prefix.
Exactly, yeah.
And so, like, our QA cluster is so heavily used that there's no reason to spin it down on the weekends, but we're not actually, we don't feel like we're paying extra for the PR deployments that we're doing because the cluster is already pretty much a sunk cost.
Yeah. So let me. Yeah, let, that's a good thing. That wasn't obvious by how I described this. So yeah, we assume that you leave the clusters online or whatnot. But if you have like the Kubernetes autoscaler deployed, as you're deploying more preview environments, you get more nodes that come online, and that means that that's a continuous cost for operating those preview environments. Versus if you were to destroy some of those, the overall size and operating cost of your cluster would go down.
Right.
I've had issues with spinning down some environments where the limits on the number of SSL certificates from that free thing that is automated
Nothing here.
would kick in, and I
Yeah.
would stop being able to get new certificates after a while.
Yeah. No, that's totally something. That's a separate topic in and of itself. I'll answer that one in a second. So the one of the things that we've done for this same customer that we're talking about is we rolled out SpotInst Ocean. Ocean is a separate controller for Kubernetes that manages node pools for you, and that way you can at least use preemptable spot instances for your staging cluster and reduce your operating costs there with the trade-off of perhaps a little bit of instability when pods get rescheduled. So what Christian was just talking about is totally a thing, especially when you're dealing with preview environments. So Let's Encrypt has a whole lot of different kinds of rate limits, and these apply to the number of certificates that were generated to per top-level domain, the number of certificates that were regenerated per week. I think Jeremy, you probably remember what some of those other rate limits are, but there are quite a lot of them. And the problem with these rate
The
limits, yeah, go on.
one that you hit with preview environments is 5 reissues per week.
Yeah. So you can only reissue. So if you're destroying that namespace, which would destroy the secret that contains the certificate, then it'll have to reissue that certificate. So you don't want to delete those if you want to avoid those rate limits. But there's another fix. I'll get to that in a second. Let's see, where was I? So with these rate limits, the problem is Let's Encrypt as a free service doesn't even give you an escape hatch of paying to increase your limits or like a support email where you can ask for those limits to be raised. So you are dead in the water if you exceed the rate limits for Let's Encrypt, and that's just something to be very aware of. So the way you mitigate the problem that you encountered there, Christian, is you use a wildcard certificate on the service load balancer for the ingress for that preview environment. So we deploy a secondary ingress for for preview environments that have their own TLS certificate with a wildcard. And that way we only generate one certificate pretty much ever, unless we destroy the ingress.
Yeah, in my case, I was deleting the whole cluster and recreating the whole cluster, right? To save money.
Okay, then you're just, if you're ACM. Then you pretty much just have to use ACM certificates on your load balance. Yeah. So, good point. Brian, are you using Let's Encrypt at all on your ephemeral or disposable clusters?
We aren't, just because of the rate limiting. We have so many. So our demo cluster probably has like 200 different deployments, and we just don't want to run into the rate limit problem.
What is your strategy for managing ACM certificates that you use with Kubernetes?
Well, we only have everything is subdomain. So like you can just imagine like blah.demo.whatever.com and then like blah2.demo.whatever.com. So it's like we just use one single wildcard.
You're using a single zone with flat DNS.
Wildcard
certificate.
That makes it easy for us to do like things like the cluster, ephemeral clusters. So when we update the Route 53 record, we don't even update the Route 53 record anymore because we use Global Accelerator. But when we did, it was wildcard Route 53. So we'd only update one record.
That's cool. That's cool. You're using the Global Accelerator. When did you guys roll that out?
We rolled it out a couple months ago. It's been working pretty well. It's quite cheap for what it provides. And it's improved the usage of our app with our customers in the UK and China and other parts of the world. And it was super easy to integrate. So much easier to fix that than some app, micro performance issues within the application itself.
Yeah, nice. Well, we should probably have a session where we just go over usage of Global Accelerator at some point. That'd be cool. I think this is the first time it's even been brought up in office hours. So
we use it too, quite a lot actually.
Oh, cool, Pepe.
Yeah. Very cool.
How are you using the AWS Global Accelerator?
We have customers that require firewall whitelisting for IPs. Mm-hmm. Banks in different parts of the country. Australia, I think, is mandatory to do that somehow. I don't know.
Okay.
And so we actually have to have a fixed IP endpoint instead of the CloudFront endpoint. So we end up using Global Accelerator, which, funny enough, is faster. Like if you're inside of AWS and you hit an internal ALB, and you measure that time, the time that the connection took, and then you enable Global Accelerator with an external ALB, is actually faster than hitting the internal ALB.
Interesting.
Quite a lot faster. It's like 100 milliseconds faster, which is like what? So I guess that they sell this super fast intranet where they have, where they connect Global Accelerator. So I don't know. It's interesting.
That's cool. So the next question that I kind of picked up here just from our Slack community was, is there some way I can get Terraform to load a directory of variable files, var files? And this, reinterpreting the question as just basically, is there a way we can have a lot of configuration files? There's a pretty nice answer to this. So I thought, since there's a lot of folks using Terraform to call out this solution. So there's a number of, you guys, am I sharing my screen here? You see this?
Yep.
Okay, cool. For some reason, I don't see the highlight that I'm used to seeing. All right. So the one obvious way, if you're using Terraform, is that you could use the .auto.tfvars extension. So you could have lots of var files with .auto, and then Terraform will automatically load those files at runtime and pass those into your variables. But if you want to have more programmatic control over which configurations are loaded, you can't do that with var files. You'd have to do it another way. And with Terraform 0.12 or HCL2, some nice things became available, and that is that you can use the YAML decode function. So you can read a file in using read file, and then parse that file as YAML, and then use that file as a local for that configuration. And then, you know, with for loops and the rest, there's a really nice way of programmatically loading in configuration files with YAML. So this is near and dear to my heart, because more and more what we're doing at Cloud Posse is using YAML as our configuration format, using Terraform for the business logic, and then using maybe Terraform Cloud as the controller that executes everything and does the continuous delivery. So here's an example in our Terraform OpsGenie incident management module. We have an example of how to use a config file. And in this case, you have a directory with a bunch of YAML files, and we load all of those. We merge all of those YAML files into one local called OpsGenie resources. And obviously this can be further parameterized as much as you need to do within your application. The way we're using that in a nice way is more and more with, let's see where I saved that, if I did here. Created just recently. Yeah, so here's one way that we're using YAML configuration files regularly. And in this case, we've defined our own schema for YAML configuration file. Top level is workflows, where we define, how should a plan all work? Well, we want to plan on each one of these projects. But going further on down here, we have our YAML configuration for projects. So we have like globals, we have Terraform configuration settings, so Terraform, VPC, and all the variables that get passed there. We have EFS and all the variables for that, transit gateway, Postgres, EKS, etc. So this is a nice way of consolidating all the configuration in a single config file, rather than sprawling it across in 25 or 50 different var files, which has been the Terraform way of doing a lot of things. All right, any questions on how to load configurations programmatically?
One thing, can you guys hear me?
Yep. Hey, Oliver.
I've started using that technique as well, and it works. It's really neat, for sure. The one thing that I'm missing when I use it is the, you don't get your editor helping you figure out what properties are in there. there's no way to specify a schema for your YAML right now, anyways, that I know of. Whereas with the, with var files and so forth, you get a little bit of, completion, auto-completion, stuff like that. So,
yeah.
I'll second that. I was doing, so this is Eric Berg. I was doing some work with this OpsGenie module with the config module, and yeah, it's a little frustrating. It feels like you should be working in a templated environment once you're into the config, but you're not. So there's no completion, none of that stuff. Still very cool though.
What are you willing to what are the things that you're wishing it would complete on in the configuration?
Well, I remember, for instance, so, you have a YAML structure, and sometimes you're accessing a property that's two or three or four levels deep.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember the names vaguely, and you can't do, ABC dot DEF dot, then it'll complete, it'll, okay. It's not going to introspect your YAML file to see what's available. Kind of thing.
Yeah, I was looking at it the wrong way. You're saying actually in the Terraform code, when you're referencing the locals.
Exactly.
Getting the completion versus in the YAML configuration, you're not talking about completion.
Yeah.
The YAML configuration itself. I got you. Yeah, so there's...
Actually, I found that in the YAML, there were a bunch of times where I needed to, and I don't have a good example for you right now, I can take a look at the config. But like, oh, for instance, like if you're referencing a team and you're creating, you know, a schedule and you want to reference a team, you have to hard code that. Rife with possibilities of screwing that up. I would really love to be able to like, oh, let me just, you know, autocomplete all of the teams that are, you know, that would be the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
Yeah. I have an example of where we get around this. I'm just trying to see if I can share an example that is not sensitive, if you give me a second. So one of the things that we do is that, so we run this in two ways. We run this on the command line with a CLI, and we run this in Terraform Cloud, where we put these settings that were in the YAML into Terraform Cloud variables. And the interesting thing is then you do get validation at least. And I haven't tried the completion thing if that would work, but I'll show you a quick example of what that looks like. Just give me a second here. So, nodes. Oh, I'm looking in the wrong, hold on. Yeah, so if you take the variables and then you serialize them to a JSON file, the stuff in the YAML, which would be the way we do it when running on the command line, then you get something that looks like this. So here we define a variable for node groups. And all the types for each one of those properties of the node group. So I'm guessing when we do it this way, and since we have a variable, then you're going to get the completion that you're still looking for. And this works because what we do is, so for Terraform Cloud, we can write that YAML configuration. So EKS, this is a different config, but like, so here, like this here, this is a map with a list. We can write that map with a list to a variable in Terraform Cloud so that when Terraform Cloud calls our workspace, it passes it in as a Terraform bar. So even though we have YAML here as the YAML is what we're interacting with, when we synchronize this YAML to Terraform Cloud, it gets synchronized as Terraform variables. We're going to have a working example of all of this in probably 2 or 3 weeks. We have the module already in progress, but we haven't merged our first release of it yet. So we'll do a separate talk on how to do this with Terraform Cloud. On that, let's see. Any questions on that before I move on to the next topic?
Was there a big summary of like what the benefits of using Terraform Cloud were there versus some other solution?
Oh, very faint there. Someone was talking.
Sorry, that was me. I'm not sure where my mic is. I was just asking if there was a clear difference on what the benefit of using Terraform Cloud there was over some other solution.
Okay, gotcha. So benefits of Terraform Cloud over, say, Atlantis or something, maybe. So one of the benefits with Terraform Cloud over Atlantis for this particular solution or scenario is that with Atlantis, there's no way to store the settings for a workspace. So with Atlantis, it assumes kind of a directory-based file organization for everything. So in Terraform Cloud, you create a workspace pointed to some VCS repository, and you can have as many workspaces pointed to that repository. You can create 10, and you can make each workspace differentiated by setting its variables as something different. So this is environment one, environment two, environment three, environment four, but they all point to the same exact repository.
I think that helps.
I forget Atlantis.
What was that, Pepe?
Which is why I fork Atlantis, and I added that option to define a YAML file in the same repo.
Oh, okay.
So you can have multiple environments, which is kind of like the same idea that Terraform.
Yeah. It's frustrating that, we wanted that in the very beginning when we started using Atlantis, and we patched it as well. We forked it and added that, but we've just stopped. Here's my kind of, professional observation is that there are a lot of great tools that have come up around Terraform, Terragrunt, Spacelift, Atlantis, but if it's not what HashiCorp is intending the direction to be, you're taking a risk that it's going to continue to work for you as the product evolves and changes. So one interesting example of this is actually related to one of the questions here. Let me go to this slide here. Can anyone chime in on the pros and cons of using Terraform workspaces? And this is a good question, one that we've done a mea culpa on or an about face on at Cloud Posse.
I use workspaces.
Was that a question? I didn't hear the first part of it.
No, I was just saying that I've been using workspaces probably for like the last four-ish years now. The reason why we used it was because of the ability to kind of do less or more dry Terraform code. I think in hindsight, if I were to start fresh now, I probably wouldn't use it. We kind of do a whole setting the variables as like maps to strings and then using the workspace to kind of or interpolate the workspace and like use that to decide which variables to use, which at this point, when you have a bunch of variables, they're all like map string types. It's just not, I don't think it's as clean anymore as opposed to like the way you guys are doing it now versus like just like a file per environment instead. Or YAML file per environment.
So we Cloud Posse has this, we've done a total about face this year, starting in January. I'm still in like February. To me, this year has just started, even though this year is almost over. I don't know about anybody else, but COVID has totally messed with that with me. So for all year, we've moved over to using workspaces, open source Terraform workspaces is what I'm talking about right here. And the benefit with that, I agree, is that in some ways it makes it a lot more dry. I think that there's a lot of folks in the community using Terragrunt and they would probably differ with that opinion, and they're just two ways of doing it. So my opinion on this has been that, look, Terraform used to never recommend using workspaces for different like stages, like production and dev and testing. They said that was not a recommended way of doing it. But that language has now been removed from the Terraform documentation, and now they promote using workspaces, although technically the way workspaces work in Terraform Cloud, and this is more confusing, is a little bit different than the way workspaces work in Terraform open source. But conceptually, they're still the same thing where you operate on the same code, but in a different state.
There's also the caveat that the Terraform workspace in the cloud actually doesn't integrate with the Terraform workspace CLI. Or open source Terraform.
Yeah, they're different.
In Terraform Cloud, they're different. So like you can't even use your workspace in your remote execution, because everything in Terraform Cloud is actually the default open source workspace. And so like if you're using the works, the Terraform Cloud workspace to make decisions, like we use ours to, our workspace names are always like environment underscore the region that it's deployed in. And so we use that information to make decisions within Terraform. And so we had to actually use a little workaround where you actually add the workspace variable in the Terraform Cloud workspace and then reference that. Paste kind of how we do that. We didn't make this up ourselves. There's a Terraform issue open that people complain about this about, and that it's kind of the workaround everybody's been using.
All right, let me pull it up here.
Hey Brian, to your point about, you know, having the pain of having, it sounds like you do one var file that then you use all of your vars are as part of like one single map that you then, you know, depending on the workspace.
Yeah.
Is it not that you had the ability when you set that up, it sounds like you set it up a number of years ago, but is it not that you had the ability to separate that out into different var files and then just use the var file that corresponds to the workspace name?
You can't do that with Terraform Cloud.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I thought you were talking about open source, Brian.
But we use both Terraform Cloud and the CLI. But to your point, we actually use like the map to make, or we pass in the Terraform workspace into like certain variables as a map. So like say like region, for example, it'd be like region and then like we pass in the Terraform workspace to the region variable, and then that would, you know, make decisions based off of that. I don't know if there's a good way to do that type of logic with separate variable files. I think you do need that like map to string.
Maybe it's a Terraform Cloud thing that I don't understand. I've used Terraform Cloud before, but only lightly.
I can probably show like an example. Let's see. If you want, I can share my screen real quick, Eric.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Try to find a good example, sorry. Yeah, okay. Something like this, we use the map to like pass in the, you can imagine like the workspace instead of local environment, but then like we have variable files that are just like for each, like this is the workspace that gets passed in or something. I don't know if you can do that with, this isn't the best example. This one's probably better. But basically, we basically use these like map, these like maps, and then we pass in. Imagine this is like Terraform.workspace. We don't actually have to change this up because of Terraform Cloud, but it used to be something like this, and then we just have the workspace here, and then the different maps to like different, you can imagine like US East 2.
That's pretty clean. I like the way you did that.
The way we've been moving in the direction of using like, I don't know, mbars and like YAML files to like configure specific like environments. I don't know, maybe the grass is green on the other side. This has worked well for us. It's kind of just this like I think the type map string thing is kind of something that I feel like is a little bit of an anti-pattern, but I don't know if that's just self-conscious. I don't know.
Yeah. Cool. Where I see this pattern working well, if one wants to adopt it as an alternative, especially is in root modules, which are the, you know, the most opinionated level, which is for your organization and your business logic. Cool. Thanks, Brian, for sharing that. That was cool. And let's see here. I'm going to share.
I think one good thing about having it as the everything in one variables file is it makes it easier to like kind of see all the different environment differences all in one file versus like having it in like, imagine you had, for us, we all like a lot of our Terraform is only for like three different environments. So it's not terrible if you had it in like a dev file and a QA file and a prod file, but if you had more than that, it might become unbearable.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So let's cover another question that was asked in the community this week. Which was, what are some of the advantages maybe of using the Cloud Posse Terraform EKS modules, or just in general Cloud Posse modules over some of the ones that are in the community? And obviously, as CEO and founder of Cloud Posse, I'm going to be pretty opinionated. Oops, I clicked on the wrong
thing. Oh boy, do I have opinions about this.
Oh yeah, oh man. Here it comes. Self-promotion now. Okay. So, wow, this was also a hot button topic of 51 replies. I didn't realize there was quite that many replies on this one. But one of the big differences between the Cloud Posse modules and some of the ones you're going to find in the community ecosystem, we're talking Terraform AWS modules as well as just general ones around the web, is that our modules were all built to be internally consistent. So the way we pass variables between our modules is almost always the same. So we always support namespace, we always support name, label, label order, these things that are available. If you look at the Terraform null label module, this is central to all of our modules. And this is what we do to ensure that all of our modules work with all of our other modules. As you work with a lot of Terraform modules, you realize that isn't always the case. Not all modules are designed to be instantiated any number of times just by changing some variables. They have a lot of hard-coded resource names that might create conflicts if you try and deploy that module a couple times. So that's one of the big reasons why you'd want to consider using Cloud Posse modules. But the other really important one is that we have integration tests for every single module that is HCL2. We have integration tests. In fact, that was a requirement for us to adopt HCL2. So if you go into any one of our modules, you'll see that is HCL2. You'll see a test folder with a source subdirectory with our Go Terra tests. These are, totally comprehensive, like the test coverage doesn't cover every variable on or off and doesn't do a full matrix, but it does cover the 80% of cases that cause most modules to fail, which is, do they plan, do they apply, do they destroy cleanly? And that's one thing that we assure with all of our modules that they do. And that's what allows us to accept pull requests more quickly than some other projects. Even that, though, has struggled because we get a lot of pull requests. All right, so that's me saying my two cents. Anybody have any pros or dissensions to that?
So the question was specifically about the EKS module, so I want to talk about that one.
Yeah.
So I have personal experience with that module. The one that the guy was talking about. Not the Cloud Posse one, the Terraform AWS modules one.
Yeah.
And I used it in production for like a year, and it was terrible. Oh my God, it was awful. But the reason was, like, it was one guy, you know, maintaining it in his free time, and they were constantly, you know, accepting pull requests with breaking changes and stuff. And you know, after finding Cloud Posse and switching things over, it's just been so much more stable all over, altogether. So that's my two cents.
I think conceptually, this is also an important thing to realize about our modules and how we architect them, is that our modules are designed to do one thing really well. And we try to, while modules should be opinionated about something, they shouldn't be so opinionated that your business logic becomes unmanageable. So one of the big differentiators between this EKS module and Cloud Posse is that what we did is we decomposed it from day one into lots of different modules so that the business logic and the versioning is disconnected. So we have one module just for the EKS cluster resource itself, one module for the EKS workers using an autoscale group, one using the EKS managed node group, one using the Fargate profile, and we're probably going to be releasing a node pool flavor for spotinst.io soon, but we haven't yet worked out the details for that. But it's nice because we're able to move faster without having to worry about testing every scenario that we keep it and maintain it backwards compatibility.
I've used the AWS module, ZKS module, and yeah, they had some breaking changes, but those were because they were new features either in Terraform or in EKS. And I was fine with that.
Yeah, they.
I see the Cloud Posse modules being significantly more opinionated. As you've said, you use the same tags for absolutely all your modules and all your resources. I think those are way too many tags that may not be needed, or maybe I don't like the name of them. There are also the Terraform AWS modules and the maintainers are also looking into splitting this module up into a bunch of smaller modules, because now that EKS has evolved so much with from just having EC2 to managed node groups to Fargate to all that jazz, and it's becoming a bit unmaintainable. But I've used it in production, and yeah, there have been breaking changes, but I wouldn't fault them for that.
Yeah, and you know, I think the issue here is I've commented even on this one. I forget what unmanageable or something. I forget what the issue is.
The one in the middle.
Oh, it's complexity. It's search for complexity.
Yeah, that one.
So this is the big one, and this was kind of a reflection on like exactly what you guys are talking about. And did the module get too much? Look at this, Mr. Andrew himself, first comment.
Andrew, that loser.
Hashtag first. Yeah, posted some things. I gave my two cents, which is a little different. Like, I mean, one of the things I thought was compelling about the community module was that, you know, it was a very easy starting point for anybody wanting to get started with EKS. But the fact that every node group flavor and the node group architecture and node groups are like integral to how you architect Kubernetes, and the fact that that is baked into one module, that to me, yeah, we're arguing like tit for tat. No, this is more opinionated. That's more opinionated. To me, that's more opinionated on the architecture side. Whether or not we have a consistent convention on naming, yeah, we're opinionated on that. I take that one on the chin for our naming convention. One thing though to note on the null label stuff, that we've done some amazing things lately to support the full. So null label is opinionated, but it is also incredibly flexible in terms of the number of parameters that it supports and the escape hatch with attributes and the ordering of it with label order. The problem was we didn't support label order everywhere. So people who wanted to have their resources named differently couldn't do that because we didn't support it. Now we're probably at least halfway through, if not more, updating all of our modules to support a pattern that we call context.tf. And that's, if you look in the exports folder of null label, that's this context file. We drop this context file into every one of our modules now, and we ensure interoperability and maintainability as we introduce new modules and update them.
I just did the upgrade for a couple of my root modules for my current project to using context.tf, and I would say big thumbs up in this regard. I think it really kind of slims things down and makes it kind of nice that you just pass around this single module that really kind of provides all the tags across all resources. And when you're in a, you know, multi-account organization, you know, having those tags for billing purposes is really critical. And that's like, I basically look away from the Terraform AWS modules and look towards Cloud Posse, just because if I can stay consistent in terms of tags and naming, then I know that, hey, I'll be able to find this, my team members will be able to find this, and the people that are in charge of billing for this organization are going to be able to find, you know, split it up to X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that vote of confidence, Matt.
I'll second that. Null label is amazing, and having consistency in labels for everything without having to stress about doing it yourself is just life-saving.
I've been using null label in my own modules even, because it makes a ton of sense to have that standardized naming format for, you know, it's a lot easier on the user of my modules to be asked, okay, what's the namespace, what's the stage, and what's the name?
Yeah.
You know, they understand that, they get that, you know, versus just kind of willy-nilly naming whatever they want.
Yeah, come up with a name, ask the user to come up with a good name. Man, that's one of the hardest things ever we struggle with. So, also what's cool about this is that now if you're using this, if you set the tags, you know, at the root level, those will be propagated to every other module all the way down. So your tagging for billing purposes should persist. Also, it was Jeremy on the call, actually. This was one of his big pet peeves that he helped us get this implemented.
Yeah, well, Eric and I put our heads together to come up with this context TF. I hate the fact that we used to have to copy and paste all of these attributes all over the place. And then when we added an attribute to null label, we had to copy and paste everywhere, all over the code. It was just very unpleasant.
Yeah.
And I wanted this context TF file. I wanted to say, look, let's just have a file that we dump into every project and it takes care of it. And I think that was Eric's idea when he got started, but he didn't.
Yeah.
Terraform was then at version 11 and didn't really have the support that we needed. But now that we were moving to Terraform 13 and I had a better handle on what we could do, we came up with a system where the null label still has all of the logic, but by simply updating this one file, we bring any once we've converted over to this format, as null label evolves. I mean, we just recently added this length limit on IDs. You know, nothing had supported that before because that was new. If we add a new feature like that to null label, all we need to do to roll it out to all of our modules once we're done with this conversion is update that context TF file in all of the repos.
Only 150 pull requests, but it's a whole lot better than what it was before.
Does this length limit truncate or fail if the length is too long?
It's truncate with a hash to try and keep it unique.
Got it. Okay. That's what I was struggling trying to figure out a way to. I have a resource that cannot be longer than 63 characters, but it's way down in my, you know, Helm file versus bubbling up all the way to the top of the Terraform. And I was wondering if there's a decent way to make Terraform fail if a variable is longer than a certain number of characters.
0 to 13, I think that's possible, right? With the validation?
Yeah, there's variable validation in Terraform 13.
You can write
an arbitrary validation rule for variables.
I'm going to have to look into that.
But overstating it, but a pretty flexible one.
Yeah, are we doing that in the EKS module? I forget.
Oh, somewhere we're doing it. We're doing it in null label, I think. But let's go just look for validate.
Fantastic. I found it. It's right here. I'll post it in Office Hours. Yeah.
This was an option also to use in Terraform 12, but you had to...
Was validation an option in Terraform 0.12?
It was an experimental option that you could enable with the feature flag towards the end of Terraform 12.
Hey, Martin, good to see you around, man. Long time.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going well. It's going well. All right, so let's see what else. We only got a few more minutes left. Let's see what one of the most pressed. Let's see in the Office Hours channel what any other questions are. Brian, I think you had a question earlier.
Grafana, I did, I thought you had a few other pinned that you can go over yet. I just sent mine today.
Yeah, it was just that day. Well, I like to, you know, you're a regular. I'd like to see if I can help answer you quickly here, if there's a good way. So, Grafana users, have you found any useful community dashboards that you would recommend? And what's the general opinion about community dashboards? Alternatively, how do you manage your Grafana dashboards? And should it be codified, read-only in the UI? Great question. Also good because we got Jeremy on the line who's spent way too much time working on Grafana dashboards from an automation perspective, infrastructure as code perspective. And we've also worked with a bunch of the community dashboards as well. So we have identified a list of the standard Grafana dashboards that we use. The biggest downside with like the community dashboards, I would say, is that none of them really have support for multiple clusters. So if you want to have an aggregated Prometheus and Grafana cluster and you want to be able to visualize the metrics per cluster instead, that isn't by default a parameter in those dashboards. So not a big deal. You can fork it, you can add it, but now you just added that much tech debt that you got to maintain. So the other issue with Grafana dashboards is a standard one with just infrastructure as code. That is like, let's face it, the easiest way to manage dashboards is ClickOps, you know, get it to look the right way in the UI. Designing a dashboard in YAML, not exactly that easy, or in JSON. So what the workflow ends up becoming is design it in Grafana, export it, put it back into source control, redeploy it with source control to the environments that you need it in.
That's exactly what I'm doing right now
is
creating the dashboard in Grafana and then copying the JSON.
Yeah. So then the other problem is there's like three or four or five, I don't know how many different ways of installing dashboards in Grafana, especially if you're on Kubernetes. Under Cloud Posse in Geodesic, we have a script. Jeremy, is your script in Geodesic? I forget.
I don't think it's in Geodesic.
You just use the Helm file?
No. So here's the thing that I was all excited about the Prometheus operator and in Grafana. So there it is, Grafana DB. I was excited about having dashboards as Kubernetes resources, which you can do with Prometheus operator. The problem was that those are what any of those things that get configured, those are read only. And under Grafana that we were using at the time, I think it was Grafana 5, if you wanted to make a change to anything, you couldn't do it. In order to make a change to the dashboard, you had to export it and re-import it as a separate dashboard because the configuration was read-only. So this gave you then a duplicate alternative dashboard. And if you weren't using SQL, some sort of persistence for configuration storage, other than the Kubernetes resource, then all of your changes disappeared when Grafana went away.
That's kind of my worry.
Yeah. So what we ended up doing is saying that you have to use a database backend for Grafana that's persistent. And we load the dashboards using the Grafana API. We upload the dashboards through the API so that they are part of the